You're listening to a podcast from the Media Motel. Coming up this week in episode 337, Roy Moore in Alabama. Boo. Max Clifford in the tabloids. Boo. And what's so good about St. Etienne? Hooray! It's all coming up after the beat and Too Nice to Talk To.
Hugely underrated band, in my opinion. They had a string of hit singles in the 1980s. That reached number 7 in the UK in 1980. The Beat and Too Nice to Talk To.
I'm a big fan of that tune, not least because it offers a solution to a problem that my DJ partner Letty and I often encounter, which is how on earth do you come out of Pig Bag and still keep the energy up in the room? And we both own a copy of Pig Bag, and often when we DJ together, it becomes a battle as to who presses the nuclear button first with Pig Bag. And whenever, once when I did it, she was raging because she didn't know what to do. And then she reached for Too Nice to Talk To by The Beat. And actually, that worked very well out of Pig Bag. So every time she says she doesn't know what to do out at Pig Bag, I always say to her, look, we've answered this question already. It's Too Nice to Talk To by The Beat. That's always the answer. So yes, thank you, The Beat, for solving our Pig Bag-based conundrum.
Welcome to the podcast from the Parish Council. It's episode 337. I'm Terence Stackham, and here we go, Jules. It's another one of those intros.
Oh, gosh.
Is she too nice to talk to? Let's find out. It's Juliet Harris.
Oh, that is as smooth and seamless as it always is. Hello, everyone.
It's like Bruno Brooks in the 1980s, these intros. That's what
all the people to compare yourself to, I felt you would have aimed somewhat higher, Terence, but never mind.
Real name Trevor Brooks, of course.
Oh, this is like, what's his name? Tony Beak from The Dancing, isn't it?
Antoine Dubec, yes.
Absolutely. Me and my friend take great pleasure in referring to him as Tone in all strictly dancing-related conversations.
Yes, it's one of those wonderful things, isn't it? When you think, Anton Dubek. And then when you find out his real name is Tony Beak.
And it just sums him up, really, in my opinion, anyway.
Jules, it may indicate how low expectations have sunk in American politics when a crass, reptilian, misogynist, homophobic moron loses an election and it's considered an upset.
Yes, I know, not great.
Many people have commented on this week's Senate election in Alabama, calling Doug Jones' win over the dreadful Roy Moore as a turning point, but I think it's nothing like that. If anything, I think we should look at the result and worry even further, is that the divisions in America have never been more striking since Rosa Parks sat on that bus and refused to give up her seat. Sure, some Republicans refused to vote or voted for Jones out of revulsion for Moore's grotesque views. But with 99% of the votes verified now, Jones won by a margin of only 1.5%. But of most concern, despite all that was known about Roy Moore and, his attitude towards women, 63% of white women voted for Moore, 2% of black women voted for Moore, which is, you know, it's very low, but you wonder what those 2% were thinking
quite,
of.
But anyway.
A majority, 52% of white women college graduates voted for Moore. Now, Jules, these numbers and this outcome show in America, at least in the heartlands away from the East and West Coast, totally divided on class, education, and most worryingly of all, on race.
Yeah, absolutely. I couldn't agree more. And actually, in a way, although it's not quite as obviously racially motivated, we're experiencing similar difficulties over here in Britain with our referendum, aren't we? And the idea that...
Similar split, that,
Yes, that the split was so narrow, 48-52. The split itself, Nigel Farage, the one of the self-appointed leaders of the Leave side, said, was actually quoted as saying that had it been the other way around, this was before the result, if it was the other way around, he would have challenged it and demanded another referendum, and yet here we are having to accept the quote-unquote will of the people. But yes, our divisions there very much, well, it would seem, are very much based along the idea of immigration. At least that seems to be a huge issue. And yet, like you say, it is rather, we do, it does feel like we live in a very divided society at the moment here and in America as well. I mean, the fact that the Doug Jones, the Democrat candidate, managed to win at all in Alabama is astonishing, frankly. It really is. And I do think a lot of that was to do with Roy Moore's unsavoury views. I do think that there was a large element, and I haven't seen any turnout figures yet, but I would be very interested to see if it can be. And of course, the difficulty with turnout and voting is that it's difficult to measure people staying at home, isn't it? You can look at a turnout, but you can't use the turnout figure to directly make the link. For example, over here in Britain, I was talking to an MP recently about the 2017 election results, talking to a Labour MP, and we were discussing the kind of the where the campaign switched and at what moment it would seem that Theresa May started to lose her advantage. And this friend of mine said that we were both sure, but she was particularly sure her seat was a marginal seat. It's now almost a state seat, really. A state seat, really, love. She had a majority of about 4,500, and she's now got a majority of something like nearly 9,000 or something ridiculous. A fairly sort of suburban, well, a sort of a suburb seat on the outskirts of a safe Labour city. And she basically said the moment at which things swung was Theresa May's rather ill-fated social care policy, because that was the moment at which she alienated a lot of her elderly voters. And my friend was actually said, I think it's worth quoting her directly, people were looking for any excuse or reason to vote Labour after that. She said after that moment, every door you knocked on, they would say, oh, but I really like my local MP, or, oh, I don't really mind Jeremy Corbyn, or, you know, there wasn't a great deal of enthusiasm, but people were still willing to sort of go back to Labour, having been tempted by the Conservatives. So to some extent, I would be interested to see whether there was a large batch of Republicans that stayed at home. And it wouldn't surprise me if there was, actually. And so to finish my anecdote from Britain, it was thought that a lot of elderly, although the Tories still won easily with elderly voters, it was thought that a lot of them stayed at home and ended up being replaced by the young people that wanted to vote Labour. So I'd be interested to see to what extent it was caused by people staying at home. And actually, strangely, I do think there is a parallel. I mean, this is a slightly clumsy parallel, but I think it's a parallel with our election over here in the UK, that one group of voters emerged to replace another group of voters, and that's what changed the result. So over here, we had elderly voters being sort of technically replaced, if they stayed at home, by young voters or people that haven't voted previously, who by and large, anecdotally, largely voted Labour. And over in the States, I wonder if here we had a situation where lots of Republicans stayed at home or voted for write-ins. There was about a 2% write-in kind of candidacy, and whether they were replaced by an enormous ethnic minority turnout. But the BAME turnout was massive, and I know that the proportion of women and men, BAME women and BAME men that voted for Doug Jones was huge. I don't think it was just proportionally huge. I think there was a huge turnout from that sector. And in a way, like you say, it does feel that we are very divided. I mean, I don't know how much to worry about 65% of white women voting for Roy Moore, because we're not, obviously we've experienced coverage of their election through our eyes over here, haven't we? I mean, I know that Twitter means that we can tap into a lot of American coverage that we wouldn't have done previously. So, for example, I often get videos from CNN and that kind of thing shared to my Twitter feed. But I'd be interested to know what the coverage was like over here, over there, because sometimes you knock on people's doors over here in Britain when, you know, we've all been bored out of our brains on TV for the last 8 to 9 weeks with the election coverage. And you knock on someone's door and they go, oh, is it today? And you think, where have you been living? Have you been in suspended animation? What has happened? And I wonder if there might be an element of people over there that just blindly wrote Republican because they always do, and who haven't really been paying attention. I know it seems like it's been an enormous, I'm not making excuses, but I know it seems like it's been an enormous thing, but you know, maybe there is an element of, oh, I didn't realize there was an election today, oh, I vote Republican, I always do. And you know, we get voters of all, I've experienced voters of all different political persuasions over here that have that same attitude, you know, oh, I always vote Labour, or I always vote Conservative, I better pop and do that now, who stop listening. And actually, the interesting thing about our election campaign over here this year was, as I said when I was talking to my friend the other day, we were talking about sort of how it was different. And I said at the beginning, when the social care thing happened, I said to someone, this will be a test of to what extent people continue to listen during election campaigns and to what extent they stop listening. And actually, people did listen. People were still listening. And I come across a lot of people who were genuinely going to switch from Labour to Tory, who then didn't because of the campaigns. And actually, it'd be interesting to see over in America, were those people voting Republican genuinely endorsing the dreadful views and behaviour of Roy Moore, or had they simply stopped listening? And actually, in a way, that shows a challenge for the Democrats. And actually, it was a challenge that Labour rose to over here unexpectedly. Do you still have the power to change people's minds and get people to hear you in the heat of an election campaign that runs along traditional lines? And the Democrats actually just about managed it because they won.
On the aspect of divisions, particularly in America, I know this is purely anecdotal, but I've got a friend who visited family in a southern US state earlier this year, and she came back to the UK overwhelmed with shock at the embedded casual racism she came across. She's white, and so many white people in this southern state treated her as one of them, and therefore spouted off at almost every opportunity about black people in the most horrendous terms in stores, gas stations, over dinner. She was deeply upset by the experience. But before we move on, there's one other statistic, just one more quick statistic published this week. It was from the rather portentously titled The World Wealth and Income Database, but I saw it through someone putting a graphic up on Twitter.
Yeah.
The top 0.1% in America own as many assets as the bottom 90%, which, put another way, 0.1% of Americans own 23% of America, the best bits, naturally. And, you know, I'm not asking for a communist-style share of assets, so I'm not ever sure either. I'm sorry that pure socialism can never work. But these people guarding everything they own and then ensuring only their children benefit from the assets, it just simply endorses that enormous split that we've been talking about right across America.
Yeah, I completely agree. And, you know, this is why, and if we make the comparison with Britain over here, this is why, to quote the hysteria of the Daily Mail this week, we are perhaps not a million miles away from nearly having a Marxist in number 10, because actually, you know, society appears to be so skewed in various different ways, and I think this is across the West actually, that, you know, people are starting to think about alternative solutions which they might not have dreamed of years ago, because we are, you know, why are we in a situation, if we go along traditional lines, I was talking to my dad about this last night, of young people voting Labour and very old people voting Conservative, you would usually expect that the stage at which people would switch their vote from Labour to Tory to be, I don't know, you know, once you've got yourself going, maybe late 20s, early 30s. In the last election, they managed to pin down the exact point at which people switched, and they said it was 47. And that is really quite old compared to, no offence to anyone who is 47, but that's older than perhaps you would think.
It is,
And, you know, the fundamentals of the society in which we live, so, you know, housing, you know, basic needs such as food, that, you know, the work, that sort of thing, are so, you know, it is almost, we've talked about this on the podcast before several times in the context of London and beyond, you know, it is, you know, wages have not kept pace with the inflation, they've not kept pace with the rise of the cost of living, so not just inflation but other factors including housing crucially, and we're going to get to a point where people are just going to go, do you know what, I don't want the status quo anymore, it doesn't work for me, it doesn't work for my family, and then that will be really interesting to see what's going to happen then. I think
this week we learned of the death of the infamous publicist Max Clifford. Has the age of outlandish PR died out with him? That's next after Sharon Jones and the Dap Kings.
Let's
I love this so much. It's tinged with sadness since the passing of Sharon Jones. I can't remember what it was. It was fairly recently, wasn't it? But I came across this album. It came out in 2015. And it's called It's a Holiday Soul Party, Sharon Jones and the Dap Kings. And it really is a complete pleasure. I love it so much. However, I nearly picked her version of White Christmas because it is so rousing. But I've picked this to wish a happy Hanukkah to all of our Jewish listeners and their friends and families. This is Sharon Jones and that was Sharon Jones and the Dap Kings and 8 days of Hanukkah.
Extraordinary woman and band, just about a whole career guesting on other artists' recordings, and then an absolutely cracking string of singles and albums without ever having any mainstream or chart success at all of their own. Amazing.
Well, it was interesting. Yeah, I mean, they became very critically loved, didn't they? She never quite became massive, but she certainly became sort of well known later in her life. And I always liked that. When I say later in her life, unfortunately, her life was far too short. But as in, you know, she didn't become famous at 22. She became famous in her 40s and beyond. And I think that's great. So rest in peace, Sharon Jones. I thought that, or rest in power, I think, rather, because that's a great LP. And if you are looking for a Christmas record this year, a new Christmas record, I try and look for a new Christmas record every year. I do think that's worth having a go.
Yes. Listeners in the UK will probably be aware that Max Clifford died this week in jail in Cambridgeshire after being convicted as part of Operation Yew Tree. I first came across Max Clifford in a rather peculiar situation about 40 years ago. I was maybe 19 or 20 or so and working for a record company, an agency. And this was quite a strange time because as punk rock was taking off, the pop bands from the 60s were finding it hard to get gigs. And also, many of the comedians from the 50s and 60s were going through difficult times. Many names that we look back now and we sort of think, oh, they're icons of that era. They actually couldn't get work. And also at this time, colleges and universities, especially during Rag Week, would put on these really strange hybrid bills. So you'd get Susie and the Banshees, supported by the Tremolos, with the evening hosted by Frankie Howard, who at the time couldn't get work. It's extraordinary to look back now, but you know these people would have taken it. People like Max Wall, Kenneth Williams, Charlie Drake, they would take almost any gig at this time, and I used to book out these gigs and tours. So one day I got a call from this bloke, Max Clifford, and he asked me over to his office for a meeting. So I turned up at this really rather shabby, actually, couple of rooms in Mayfair. And it became apparent that he was offering me a job. Clifford was offering me a job, which he hadn't mentioned on the phone at all. And he was representing, to be fair to him, he was representing some big names at the time. And he went on and on about how he was the publicist in the UK for Frank Sinatra. And he wanted me, the idea of it was, he wanted me to bring over these new pop and punk acts and help create a sort of super agency with these old style stars from the 50s and 60s.
Yeah, absolutely.
I just didn't like him, and I liked him even less the next day when he rang me up and he offered me a salary that was so low. It wouldn't have even covered my train fares into London each week. It was absolutely ridiculous. So I turned him down, to get to the point of it. I turned him down. And the thing was, he was really grumpy about it and bad-tempered. And this was to the extent, I found this absolutely remarkable. He took such umbrage about it. All I said was, well, I couldn't afford to work for that sort of money and I don't really want the job anyway. I'm happy where I am. Thank you very much. When I met him again at a charity do about 10 years later, he went on about it again and about how I should have joined up with him. And it wasn't sort of in a jokey way. He was really snarky and resentful that, oh, all those years ago, you should have come over to me. Now, I'm wondering, Jules, the generation in which he worked, he sold stories to newspapers and then took a hefty percentage from the grubbier end of tabloid newspapers. And he was from a time when publishers had money to burn and from an almost unquestioning age when readers would believe almost anything. Now, you're young and your generation...
God bless you, we're still thinking that's true, yeah.
Your generation have grown up in the age of the internet, so you question everything. Do you think that style of showman public relations has died out with the likes of Max Clifford?
Well, I wonder. I mean, there is still PR that goes on. And actually, it's interesting. You talk about an unquestioning versus questioning age. This links into something we were talking about the other week, I think, which is various organisations, companies such as Paperchase advertising in, you know, publications such as the Daily Mail, and then ending up pulling their advertising because of the protest of people. So I do think we live in a more questioning society, or at least rather people that do want. We live in a society that's less dominated by small amounts of media. So previously, like you say, we didn't live in a questioning society. People wouldn't have, you know, even brought that up. But now, interestingly, not only do people question things more, but thanks to things like Twitter, they have a platform on which to question them, which has some sort of equal weight. I'm not saying that there aren't such a thing as what my friend calls Twitch fought mobs, because there are, and it's not always a power for good. But having said that, I do think we live, certainly media wise, in a more pluralist society than we used to. Interested that Rupert Murdoch has sold off some of his empire again, which is interesting. I do feel by selling it to Disney, we're going out of a frying pan into another frying pan. But anyway, we'll leave that for another time. But yeah, it is interesting, isn't it? I in a way, am glad that we don't just rely on the tabloids anymore. And in a way, the phone hacking scandal a few years ago now did for the News of the World, didn't it? And I know that we then had the Sun on Sunday to pop up instead. But I do feel a little bit like we've kind of moving away from the sort of fake shake tapping up of people, which Clifford was, of course, very involved in. So I am glad in a way that we are. I mean, I still think there are very big things wrong with our media in this country. I do think that there are, you know, I've talked previously about my Daily Mail concerns and all that sort of stuff. So I do have some concerns still over that. But, maybe people do. I mean, there are people still read tabloid papers such as the Mail in huge numbers, or are less huge than they used to, actually. So it'd be interesting to see if their influence is waning. What happened over here, and again, to use the election as a sort of comparison, I think we're using this as kind of a review show in a way of 2017, aren't we? It was said that one of the reasons why young people came over to Labour in large numbers was that Labour finally worked out how to run social media campaigns in an effective way. And actually, Facebook, I know lots of, oh, I don't know many, but I know a few young, what I would call kids, really, who don't use Facebook. Their view is, oh, my mum and dad use Facebook. So that might explain why the age for switching from Tory to Labour went up so high, because, you know, people in their 30s and 40s are large users of Facebook and beyond, more than young people are. But Labour ran very effective campaigns along the lines of, the fox hunting and the ivory trade thing. Went viral, really viral, and actually, you know, political commentators cited that as you know, one of the things that got more liberal younger people away from the Tories and over to Labour, along with that ridiculous citizen of nowhere stuff. And actually, interestingly, that, you know, it was the new media. The Labour's content and Jeremy Corbyn's content was shared enormously amongst, I mean, I'm 33, so lots of my associates are of my age and older, and it was shared enormously amongst my associates on Facebook. And that really did change a lot of people's mind. I think there's a great danger, and I don't want to sound like I'm smashing the mainstream press all the time, because actually I do think that, I don't think the fake news sites, fake news is not just a Breitbart right-wing phenomenon. Fake news also exists over here with the likes of Squawk Box and the Canary and that sort of thing. And I really don't think that sites that consist of one or two people sat in their bedrooms making stuff up, or in the case of the Canary, a team of people having to, there was a really interesting BuzzFeed article by Marie Leconte a little while ago about this, in that the Canary is basically a sort of a click factory, really, and they had a payment model whereby writers and contributors got paid according to web traffic, which then of course distorts journalism and makes you think, oh well, if I make things eye-catching, you know, and be a bit fast and loose with the truth, that will mean that I get paid more. And that is deeply worrying. So I'm not saying all of the new media is good. There are, you know, I think there is always going to be a place for properly sourced journalism, but what I'm glad that we hopefully might be starting to move away from is the kind of gutter journalism that Clifford practiced, of, you know, fake shakes and doorstepping people and, you know, the phone hacking as well. I don't know to what extent he was involved in that, but, you know, there are questions, I think. And you know, I do feel that if we can move away from the sort of, you know, kiss and tell tabloids, that can only be a good thing, I think.
That dichotomy between new and old media, I suppose the decline in the influence of newsprint is reflected in the equal decline in the old style of publicists and public relations experts who would woo newspaper editors and journalists. And nowadays, we're probably more likely to get an artist or an actor or a movie or whatever noticed by a tweet or a video clip going viral on social media, and that costs nothing. So it's probably no bad thing to see the back of these rather sleazy people, as you say, placing tawdry stories in the news of the world.
Yeah, absolutely.
Clifford himself actually got a payout. He was hacked himself, and he got a payout of about a million quid. Yeah. Here's a question. What's so good about Saint Etienne? That's next, right after Eliza Carthy. only one of my favourite musicians, but also one of my favourite people in the whole world, the wonderful Eliza Carthy. And from the year 2000 and her album Angels and Cigarettes, that was Whispers of Summer.
I do like Eliza Carthy. The thing I like about her is that she's been quite successful. She's very well revered on the folk scene. Obviously, she has excellent parentage, but in her own right, she's an excellent artist. But she just gets on with it. She just gets on with touring and releasing albums and making really good music, and, you know, just has a career fairly, you know, I say quietly, not quietly amongst the folk scene, but sort of on the mainstream wise, quietly. But she just does it, and I really admire that.
By the way, I should have said Eliza Carthy, MBE, and like PJ Harvey, she should be a dame.
Absolutely, I agree.
Jules, I really admire bands when it's almost impossible to define them or to try and place them in a genre, especially as years go by and maybe they widen their style. Like Saint Etienne, I know that initially they were going to try different vocalists on different songs, but quite naturally when they found Sarah Cracknell, didn't need to look elsewhere. So they've kept to the same three members for 16 years. And as we've discussed before, when looking at the longevity of other bands, from their fourth album, Good Humour, they've shared the songwriting credits between the three of them, often a crucial thing. Now, last Sunday, you went to see them at Bexhill-on-Sea, which leads us to that question. Jules, what's so good about Saint Etienne?
Well, that is a very fair question. And actually, it's interesting. You make notes of their first album, Fox Bass Alpha, and they used lots of different vocalists on that. They had a couple of singles before Sarah Cracknell sort of joined them properly. She Nothing Can Stop Us was their first single with her. But when they did all these tunes, for example, she did sing. So they Only Love Can Break Your Heart, she didn't sing on that, and I'm not sure she sung on Kiss and Make Up either. In fact, ended up singing. It was Moira Lambert originally, but when we saw them live, they sang those two songs and Sarah Cracknell sang them. So I don't know if that's a rewriting of people out of history or just her not being precious. I'm not sure. But anyway, we saw them at the Dedewald Pavilion. It's on a Sunday night. The gig had originally meant to be taking place in June to promote their latest album, which was Home Counties, that was out at the time. But it was pulled quite close to the date, I think, about a week or two away it was pulled, and said that it would be in December instead. And it would be part of their Christmas tour, because they are known for doing Christmas albums and you know, Christmas singles and that sort of thing. And so I was talking to my friends that run a record shop in Bexhill to find out why that was, and they said that they couldn't tell for sure, but they had heard whispers. So the Dedewald Pavilion where they played is a capacity 1,500, and they had heard whispers that as few as 200 to 300 tickets had been sold.
Oh my God.
And that's why that's bullet, which we were all really surprised at, because St Etienne, as you say, a very long-term band that now have that. Well, put it this way, and I don't mean it's unkindly, when we went to see St Etienne, I was amongst the younger of the kind of number there. They have a constituency of 40s and people in their 40s and 50s now who are affluent. This is why all the Britpop bands are reforming. Not that St Etienne are Britpop, this is why a lot of 90s bands are reforming, because they have an audience that is now very affluent that can go and see them. But so we went to see them at the Dead of War, and we were interested to see whether or not they had managed to sell more tickets. And the regular list is what I remember my tales of the Laura and Vula gig there. The side terraces were shut, as they were for that, and it didn't look like upstairs was open. But having said that, it was quite busy downstairs. There were a respectable amount of people there.
Well, I'm absolutely stunned by this news.
I know. I really thought that it would. But the problem is, of course, is that when bands play London, you know, that we have the, you know, that their sort of audience in the Hastings, St Helens, Bexhill area are perhaps DFLs anyway, down from London people who perhaps be more inclined to go up to London. I'm not sure, but anyway, they came on. And they didn't. I think they did Kiss and Make Up at the beginning, I think, or they did it. They opened with a number of that era. And Sarah Cracknell, who is excellent as a front woman, why is St Etienne so good? Because she is brilliant, is part of the reason. She said she sort of welcomed everybody and said that it was a wonderful venue. It was a beautiful place to play. They'd been wanting to play there for some time. And then she added, as some of you might be aware. And actually, I thought it was a very neat way of dealing with, you know, something that was actually quite irritating at the time if you bought a ticket. And what made them so great, it was a Christmassy show. They have five-piece backing bands as well, including a woman called Debsey, who originally sang in Dolly Mixture.
Oh gosh.
And, And she originally sang on Who Do You Think You Are with Sarah Cracknell, and actually since then has worked with them a great deal. And how can I put this charitably? Sarah and Pete and Bob and Debsey are not young now, but there was something lovely about the fact that, you know, but and I'm always a big fan of women that are allowed to age and can still perform music, because we are not so good at female performers aging as we are as male performers aging in society, I don't think. And actually, this is why one of my favourite bands are Ye Nunz, who I've spoken about previously, who are a bunch of women who are, you know, not especially young, and I don't mean that unkindly. You know, some of them are really good friends of mine, but women in their 40s and 50s in some cases, just getting on with it and just doing what they want to do. That is a great pleasure. And Sarah Cracknell has aged brilliantly in that she still does what she wants to do. At one point, she wore a feather boa and then said it was new and it was difficult to break it in. They did a huge amount of songs from their back catalogue as well as their new album. And actually, this is where bands of that era playing the Delawarr, I think, do well. We saw the Jesus and Mary Chain there, and they played much of their new album, and they weren't so precious that they didn't do about five or six of the hits at the end. So you know, they did lots of tunes. And actually, the although they are very much a kind of a dance band, they did some stuff with Good Humour, which was quite funky, and they did a really lovely version of Driving Home for Christmas. And they had a big screen in the background with sort of words in it, and they'd say this is a Saint Etienne Christmas show, and sometimes it would just say Saint Etienne, and during that they just had words that said get well soon Chris Rea, which I thought would be nice. And the funniest bit actually said, you know, they were great, they performed their tunes, you know, they've had a lot of hits and well-placed covers as well. So Who Do You Think You Are is actually a cover. Only Love Can Break Your Heart, which Sarah didn't originally sing on, but she did here. That was, of course, Neil Young originally. And, of course, Nothing Can Stop Us, and I think we've played this on the podcast before, is samples Dusty Springfield, I Can't Wait to See My Baby's Face. So, actually, they were very canny in that they pick good covers as well as writing great tunes. They did He's on the Phone, which suited, and they did Like a Motorway as well, which really did, it sort of it showcased their hitherto largely unseen krautrock side, actually. So they were very varied, but my favourite bit I think was at the end. I thought they would finish when I was born on Christmas Day, which they did. And usually, of course, that part is the male part. It's a duet, and the male part is sang by Tim Burgess. And I always, every year, I religiously watch Top of the Pops 2 with my dad. And every year, I hope that they will show that. And increasingly, they do, as people, as the kind of people that are watching that are aging and perhaps came from the rave era. They do show their lovely performance of that on Top of the Pops. And I knew that the Charlatans were playing in Brixton that night, so I didn't think it would be Tim Burgess. And I said to someone, I wonder who they will get to sing his role. And they then introduced Steve Mason, who is a solo artist formerly of the Beta Band and King Biscuit Time, who's quite a name, and we were quite impressed. And as they sang this song, very well received, and there was only one person in the entire building who wasn't really very sure on the words to the male part, and unfortunately that was Steve Mason.
Oh, no.
But sang off a call sheet, and unfortunately he would have got away with it had his eyesight been better. I mean, he did miss a cue at one point, which is a pity, because it meant that the gig finished on a slight, not exactly a low, but it kind of sapped the energy a bit, although I do like Steve Mason a great deal. So that was quite funny that, you know, someone said to me, how can you not know the words to that, even if you're on stage? But it was a great gig, and it was a lovely atmosphere, and they really did. It was the audiences at the Delawarr, I think, always receive things very warmly, and as a result of which bands, I think, always play well there, and I really enjoyed it. So what's the greatest about St Etienne? They're clear on what it is they do while still being open-minded to try other things, and they're not so precious as they don't want to do it. So I think that is what I love about St Etienne.
Yeah, I think along with Belle and Sebastian, they're one of my, well, they're my favourite bands, so my two favourite bands from the last couple of decades. But I think you've nailed it there, because they're never afraid to try new dimensions. They're always stylish, and that they've never needed a Max Clifford, have they?
Absolutely.
No scandals with St Etienne. Nobody ever says, I hate St Etienne. They're just sort of universally loved by everybody who knows about them. So I'm glad that was a really good gig and a good way to finish the year. But I'm still absolutely, as the young people say, gobsmacked about the ticket sales.
Yeah, absolutely.
Now, we know that most of your public appearances sell out within moments of tickets becoming available.
Well, that's not entirely true, but thank you for trying that nonetheless.
But is there anywhere where we might see or hear you this week?
So I'm doing the Saturday social this evening on Barricade Radio. It is the Christmas special, so there will be Christmas, Motown, Soul, Northern Soul, and various different things. That's 6 to 7pm, barricaderadio.com. By the way, the Barricade Radio monthly emailer is out, so if you want to go to barricaderadio.com and sign up, I will post a link on my Twitter later as well, because it includes my review of the year, so my top favourite bands, sorry, my top favourite albums, my top, my favorite singles, and also my favorite gigs. So so that's on there. I'll also be doing, there are allegedly a few tickets left next Wednesday at the Kino Theatre, because it's Russian, in St. Leonard's, where I'll be doing a talk, which I'm not allowed to say what that talk is about, but I'll be doing a 15-minute talk at the Barvard Bar evening. I will also be on the radio that evening doing the Christmas Indie Wonderland, My Big Fat Indie Christmas, which is 2 hours of Christmas-themed indie alt-rock misc, and that's 8 to 10pm, barricaderadio.com.
Now, thanks to you for listening, especially you, and thanks to executive producer Rona, of course. We're taking a break for Christmas, but we'll be back before you know it.
Absolutely, yes. Have a lovely Christmas, and or a tolerable Christmas, depending on your views of Christmas.
What are we playing out with, Jules?
Well, there's only one thing we could play out, really, after our discussion. So, sang by Tim Burgess and Sarah Cracknell, and they did know the words on this occasion. This is one of my favourite Christmas tunes, I think, because, again, they and this sums up St. Etienne, they've done something, you know, they've done perhaps something that's traditional by trying to do a Christmas song, but they've very much done it on their own way and in their own terms. And there aren't very many Christmas songs that you could say were genuinely ravey, but I do feel that this is it. And again, if you watch Shop of Pots 2 this year and this is on, or you dig it out on YouTube, it's worth watching their Christmas performance, I think, because I think it is lovely. This is Sarah Cracknell leading St. Etienne with Tim Burgess, and I Was Born on Christmas Day.
You have been listening to a DACA Media production.